Hello and welcome to episode 17 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me, as always...
Hello, I'm Ben 304, also known as 304, also known as Ben Sandler. Hello, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm alright. What's been going on?
You know, same old, working on my game, doing not working on my game, prepping for a big move.
Yeah, this is probably going to be our last podcast with you in Miami. Wow. How about that? How time flies.
Yeah, I guess it does.
Well. So listeners, enjoy the feel of Miami while you still can.
Yeah.
Unless you're listening to the podcast in Miami, because...
That's true. Know, I don't think we have any listeners in Miami, but we might. And if we do, well, say hello while you can, because I won't be here for much longer.
Yeah, man, go around and visit him while you still can. Cause he's not
but listen to the ocean in the background.
Very convincing.
That's a homeless person snoring on a bench.
Oh, convinced.
There's some seagulls. I think that's a monkey. And what else do we have? Oh, the distant sound of a club.
Don't you have dolphins?
Well, our football team are the Miami Dolphins, but they don't go at the zoo.
Oh,
calm,
man! What the? That's the seagull there.
No, I was a. Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm bad at atmosphere. I'm bad at creating atmosphere. But you know what?
I would just like to say this is the Miami Tourist Special Edition guide of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. We're actually not talking about games, we're talking about the sounds of Miami.
No. See, it all makes sense because I'm trying to create an atmosphere to give our listeners the feel that they're in Miami, but I'm feeling
the Miami atmosphere.
Yes, but atmosphere is what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
Yes. Atmosphere in games. See how
clever? And not boring atmosphere like global warming and oh boy, save the earth, boo hoo hoo. You know, not boring stuff like that. Not unimportant things like that.
No.
Like all the ozone, boo hoo, who cares?
Atmosphere like immersion and making your player feel like they're part
important
of the
stuff.
Yeah. So, how are you, Justin? I forgot to ask you how you were.
I'm pretty good. I'm good. I've got a day off, which is nice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've got a day off from my day job, but I haven't got a day off from my real job. That's my other job. That's my real job.
Yeah, that's right.
That is. So I've been doing a bit of animating. I stayed up late last night and I finished one of the games that I bought when I was in Brisbane on the last day of Bogans with Dane Crams, which was infamous too. Dane and I went to his local big mall shopping center thing.
Garden City?
That's it. And we ate $20 worth of food court food each, which I have to say is like $90 worth of normal food each. We were stuffed and then bought a couple of games each. And this one's been sitting here for ages waiting for me to play it. So I finally got around. And I finished it and I enjoyed it.
Good.
Yeah.
I remember I reviewed Infamous 2 back when we did reviews on this podcast.
Yeah, you did.
And I don't remember what I said, but
I'm pretty sure you liked it.
Probably. I'm pretty easy to please when it comes to games.
Are you?
Yeah, I can't really think of a game... Well, I can think of maybe... I can probably count the number of games I've absolutely despised and would never play again on one
hand. Yeah, because you seem to buy safe games, whereas I kind of go for the craziest stuff. Although you bought Normality recently, which isn't really a safe game.
Well, I haven't played it yet, so I can't tell you anything about it yet.
I haven't finished
it. It's in a box.
I've only played a little bit of it, so... I only bought it recently myself, but
nice.
I quite enjoyed what I played of Normality. I thought it was cute and clever, and I'd like to see more games use the first-person formula. While we're talking about atmosphere, I have to say Normality really surprised me because I expected it to have a very silly, cartoonish atmosphere, and when I played it, it's actually quite dystopian in a cheeky way, and I thought that was lovely.
Mm. Well, we'll get to our main atmosphere talk. We're still dispensing with the pleasantries.
We're pleasant guys, man. So I'm in a good mood, you know. I've finished a video game.
Good.
It was kind of short. I was expecting a longer game, or maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really remember
It's kind of weird for me because I haven't played PlayStation 3 since April. What is it now?
It's August.
August, so that's a few. That's like 4 months. That's,
yeah.
So it's kind of weird because I've been used to... One thing I noticed with Infamous 2 after playing Quake recently, which is what I had been playing, is how powerless I feel, you know? In Quake, I'm used to dodging and running and jumping and shooting, and in this, you got to take cover a lot.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So
did you do a lot of the side quests?
I did a fair few of the side. I love doing side quests in games. Yeah. Side quests? Do you like side quests in games?
I do like side quests in games, but I remember I did all of them in Infamous 2, and that stretched out the experience a little more.
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't do all of them.
Mm.
But I've got the thing where you can go back and finish what you didn't start. So,
yeah.
I find in some games, you know, the side quests are actually better. There's Kingdoms of Amalur: The Reckoning, which was made the only game that 38 Studios ever made before they went defunct, bankrupt actually, because of whatever. Is it Curt Schilling, some baseball player? I don't know baseball.
Baseball.
Mm.
What does baseball have to do with it?
He funded the company and put them.
Oh, really?
So yeah, it was a huge story about it. But anyway, so they made a single game, and that game has a main storyline, which is huge. Man, the game took me 80 hours to complete, but a lot of that was doing the side missions, which were actually better written and way more enjoyable. Well, there was a lot of side missions, but the major side missions, because it had major ones and minor ones. And go play it. It's a great game. I can see where all the criticisms come from for it, but that's besides the point because it's a great fun game.
I see.
And it's the only game that 38 Studios ever made and will ever make, which is a real damn shame.
Yeah, that's too bad. It's always sad when somebody makes a good game and then they die. Like Pandemic and The Saboteur.
Yeah, that's a shame. Was that the only game they ever made?
I don't know that that was the only game they ever made, but it was the last one that they made.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, no, 38 Studios literally went in and made a single big amazing... They, like, put all of their resources and all of their money and everything into it. It's ridiculous.
Hmm.
But, hey.
Yeah.
It's nice that they finished the game before it went into development hell or whatever happened.
Yeah.
It's just a shame people didn't buy it more.
Mm.
But, yeah.
Anyway, going to our main topic of conversation.
Yeah, because we're rambling. I don't care anymore, man. It's my day off.
Yeah, we can talk about whatever we want. It's our podcast.
This is our podcast, and we'll try.
Exactly. So let's talk about atmosphere in games, and let's start by talking about games that we've played that have had atmosphere in them that we really enjoy, and we'll have a little analysis of exactly what it is that makes it so atmospheric. For lack of a better term.
Atmosphere is a really weird thing to pin down because it's part setting, you know, it's part emotion, and emotion can be like, you know, can be just no bad gameplay choices pulling you out of the setting, which is a really stupid thing. But I think what we really want to focus on is sort of more setting than the other stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I think you should start first.
Okay. Well, just as a general idea for our listeners of what we'll talk about, we'll first talk about games that we like that have good atmosphere, like I said, and then we'll switch over and we'll talk about our own games and how we feel about creating atmosphere and general tips to make your own games more atmospheric for those of you who actually make games as well, which hopefully is a lot of you.
My major tip is do it good. that's how I feel.
Easier said than done, my friend. Easier said than done.
I know.
But I'll list off a couple of games off the top of my head that I've played recently that have, in my opinion, very good atmospheres. One of them is L.A. Noire.
Sure.
And that is a lot of people criticized the fact that it was presented as an open world game, but in reality, it's really not. And it's true; it isn't an open world game. I mean, the story is very on rails. You just have to go from one place to another, and solve the cases, and you have optional side quests, street crimes, whatever. But they've recreated this however big patch of Los Angeles in 1947, and the level of detail and just everything that has gone into it really makes you feel like you've gone back in time when you're driving around. Even though it serves no purpose whatsoever, you really just, you're driving around and you're seeing the sights and you're hearing the sounds and you're just kind of taking it all in, and you feel like you're there. And it's really cool that they can do that, that they've preserved this sort of little slice of history. And I read a few articles about people who played the game and showed it to their parents or their grandparents, people who were actually alive in that time and may or may not have lived in Los Angeles. I think that I read one article about a guy who showed it to his dad, his grandfather, who I think was dead, was a cop in LA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and back in the 40s, and he showed it to his dad because his dad kind of remembered sort of that era as well.
Sure.
And they said that, yeah, that they had done a really good job of recreating it. The only thing that he criticized was the fact that all of the cars in the game have those white tires.
The white tires.
Yeah, the white wall tires. And he said that that was really a status thing, that only you only had those if you were rich, that most cars just had the regular plain old tires.
Can I make a confession? When I was a younger man, I used to drive quite an old car, and a car from 1976, actually. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to the tire service to get my tires changed one day, and he was like, "Oh, dude, I've got these white wall tires. You want me to put them on?" I was like, "Yes!" So I've driven around with, like, I was just like, man, I felt like the king.
If I hadn't been such an idiot about learning how to drive, this is now switching into personal anecdote time. But if I hadn't been such an idiot and learned how to drive earlier, there's a good chance I may have gotten my grandfather's old red 1966 Mustang, and it didn't have white wall tires on it, but I totally would have put them on.
Of course.
Of course, I probably would have needed money to do that too, so that probably would have been a
bloody money.
Another thing, yeah. Anyway.
I still have that car from 1976 with aims of fixing it up one day.
Nice. Mm. You can
get white wall tires for it again.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyway.
Back to the subject at hand. L.A. Noire was one game that really did a good job of creating an atmosphere. And if I could, that's a AAA title. Another AAA title that I've always felt did a really good job of creating atmosphere. We've all played the Assassin's... Well, most of us have played the Assassin's Creed games, and...
I don't know.
A fair few of us have. But
right.
I'm not going to cite all of them, because not all of them, I don't think, pull it off that well. I'm going to cite Assassin's Creed 2 as the one which does it the best, because walking around Renaissance era Florence and Venice and those Italian towns, they really did a nice job of having the people shouting in the streets and just hearing the sounds and seeing sights. And you know, if they had smell-o-vision, I'm sure you could smell the sewage and the disease,
which would probably break the immersion a little, to be honest.
Well, yeah, but you know, whatever.
So, to be honest, the amount of sewers that you go in games, I'm glad they haven't invented a way to incorporate scents into games.
Yeah, you're like, absolutely right. Like,
seriously, who wants the scent of a sewer while you're playing a game?
Yeah, I know.
And you're always in sewers.
Yeah, it's a thing. Yeah, so in Assassin's Creed 2, I guess I'm a little bit biased, because as is obvious from my citing of L.A. Noire and this, and Assassin's Creed 2, I'm a history nerd. So getting to walk around these historical periods is really cool. And having been to Florence after playing Assassin's Creed 2, I was just like, wow, this is great. And I've been to L.A. after playing L.A. Noire as well. And getting to actually be in the places that you're in after having played them is pretty cool.
I think it's funny that you mentioned both open world games so far. Well,
yeah,
but you know, not open world, but open environments.
Yeah, open environments. And another one that I'll mention as well is Grand Theft Auto 4, which you hated.
I didn't hate Grand Theft Auto 4. I hated certain decisions that they made, which I thought were preposterous.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people complained that there wasn't a lot to do in Grand Theft Auto 4.
Oh, there was too much to do.
Really? Well, people wanted San Andreas. They wanted to skydive. They wanted to fly planes. They wanted to... Yeah, yeah.
You know what I miss the most? I miss the tractors and hooking them together. I love that in San Andreas.
Well, you might get that in GTA 5.
Oh, man. Do you know what I want to do? I want to do the swimming, which I'll talk about later.
Okay. Well, anyway, so Grand Theft Auto 4, Liberty City felt like a living, breathing city, as they always say. And also, Red Dead Redemption felt like you were in the West. You know, you're riding along with your horse, and you see the sunset and the mountains and the fields and stuff, and you feel like you're in the Old West. I'll tell you one thing. One great indicator to me of atmosphere in games is, and I'll cite Red Dead Redemption for this, I always have my air conditioning on, except for when we have podcasts like now, because it makes noise. But it's hot where I live, and I always have my air conditioning on. And
it's hot where I live, too.
Yeah, if I'm playing a game and I'm in an icy area, like in Red Dead Redemption when you go up to the mountains, and I feel cold, that's how I know the game is doing a good job of creating its atmosphere.
I love the mountains. Now that you mention it, I love going around the mountains and like being hunted by bears.
Every single area of Red Dead Redemption, I think, just is atmospheric.
There's
amazing.
Nothing... Can I? Oh, man, I was just talking about Infamous 2 before, which I got from Brisbane when I was with Dan Crams, and the other game I got,
you got
was
Undead Nightmare.
Yeah, Undead Nightmare, and I'm really nervous to play it because I love Red Dead Redemption so much, and I'm really worried that it will turn it into just a joke.
Well,
when really Red Dead's such a pretty and lovely and brooding game, you know.
If you treat it as a what-if scenario in an alternate universe, it shouldn't taint the original. It's not... It's very moody because obviously it deals with zombies, so it's a lot foggier and it's a lot darker.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'm still nervous to play it.
You'll be fine.
Okay.
But anyway, there's that bit in Red Dead Redemption where you're kind of going from the McFarlane Ranch up to West Elizabeth, and you pass through Thieves Landing, and it just kind of suddenly gets darker and rainier, and you go from being out in the plains to being out into like the Louisiana swamp. I love Thieves Landing. I think Thieves Landing is probably my favorite area on that whole map because
it's very
swampy, sort of Louisiana nighttime sort of thing.
It does. This is something I really like about Red Dead Redemption, is a lot of times you get an open world game and it doesn't feel like an open world. It feels like one city. Like let's take Liberty City, for example, or Vice City. It feels like a single location, whereas Red Dead, man, you've got the snowy mountains, you've got the swamps of Louisiana, you've got the open, like, the desert plains, you know.
You've got Mexico.
Yeah, there's heat. And then you've got a sort of... I love the fact that you've got, like, old sort of poor cities and, like, military fortresses, and then also more modern cities with, like, motor vehicles driving around.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's something I really like. But we're getting off the topic. What else do you like? Is there any non-open world games that you think have good atmosphere?
Yes, I'll tell you one that affected me quite a bit as a child, or as a young, impressionable preteen, was The Secret of Monkey Island. Walking around Melee Island at night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just those blues and the contrast with the shops lit up and the yellow windows. And
I think the most atmospheric part of that game for me was the Caverns of Meat. I love the Caverns of Meat.
See, I like Melee Island, the town, and just the whole island itself.
So I like
it really felt like you were in a Caribbean on a Caribbean island at night.
Okay, good.
Which was great. So I've talked ad nauseum. Tell me some games that you like that have.
I think The Dig has great atmosphere.
Okay.
I love the way it feels. It's probably LucasArts' game that feels the most like a film. you know, obviously, because Spielberg had some influence in there. He didn't have as much influence as he was originally going to have, but I think the dig, there's that, you know, that screen. I've talked about that screen before. There's that screen with the water lapping at the thing, and there's just the color palette really, for me, makes it this really, I could just sit and look at that for hours, man. If I could have that scene with the water lapping animating as my desktop background, I would. I just, and like have like the character walking around and me click on an icon and he walks over to it and uses it. That would be my ultimate ideal desktop. I don't know why someone hasn't built this yet. What are you doing, people? Seriously, I've been, how long has the dig been out for? It's been like 20 years.
Yeah, it'll be about 20 years in a year or two.
There you go. You've had all this time. So you were talking about open world games before. And I agree with some of those. I think Vice City works with the visuals and the sound to make an amazing atmosphere of the 80s. Vice City is so atmospheric that I've literally spent like an hour some nights just riding around in Vice City with the radio on a motorbike, just enjoying the city. That's atmosphere for me. If a game does that for me, you know, if I'm happy to just drive around in a game in which you can shoot and jump and do all this crazy stuff, if I'm happy to just drive around and listen to the radio, that's pretty atmospheric.
Yeah, I felt the same way about Vice City, and more so because I live in the city it's based on, so it was for me.
You nearly don't live in there, man. Next thing you know, you'll be spending your whole life playing GTA 4 just driving around instead of going outside and driving around. I also like, I really like, and you were talking about how you like cities because of you're a history nerd and you like going around these cities, but I like Omicron the Nomad Soul's atmosphere. And I remember when it first came out, and I would have been, I don't know, sort of 12 or 11, and it was the first open-world game I ever played. It was one of the first open-world 3D games ever made, I think. And I remember just walking around the city, and there's this feeling of just, there was this sudden feeling of, man, I can do anything, you know? I can just go anywhere. Like, I can just walk here, and I can call my car, and my car comes to me, and I can go and explore people's apartments and stuff like this. It was amazing. That really, for me, showcases the way even a fictional city, if you've got a strong setting, you know, because Omicron has quite unique visuals and soundtrack. It's very, it makes all of David Cage's other games look quite boring and dull. Although another game which is great atmosphere, especially at the very, 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 very start, is Indigo Prophecy or Fahrenheit. I don't know. Yeah. What do you guys call it there? I can't remember which I'm supposed to call it, because I call it both.
The North American version is Indigo Prophecy, and it's Fahrenheit everywhere else. I call it Fahrenheit because I have Fahrenheit, because I bought it in the UK, because I didn't want my version censored.
Right, because you want to see the weird polygon breasts.
Yep.
Yeah, so I really like that very start bit when you're in the diner, and there's that murder scene, and I think it really builds the atmosphere, being able to see the guy coming for you. It really sort of amps up the pressure. And
I found that split screen.
Yeah, I wish that was used more, you know? I mean, it's used a little bit here and there throughout the game. I like the scene in the park where you have to make a decision in the snowy park whether you, like, save the guy or run.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, if I can rant a little bit about Fahrenheit, and this has nothing to do with atmosphere, but this is just a little side rant as far as game design goes. But let's see if you agree with me. I'm save this a rant there.
No, go on.
I'm of the opinion that Fahrenheit could have been saved and been a lot more tense and, you know, not been what? So... Well...
If David Cage wasn't writing it, yeah, I agree.
Well, there's that. But
sorry, David.
But as you know, you're playing as Lucas, and you're also playing as the cops. So you have the interesting experience of being the suspect at the murder scene and then being the cops investigating this person. And it's just something about the fact that you're playing as the criminal and the cops investigating the same criminal That just seems kind of self-defeating, because what's the point of covering up your crime if you as the cop...
The cop
doesn't know where it is, but you as the player already know where it is, you know? If you have to find the knife or whatever, you know, okay, it changes the story, but you already know where he hid the knife.
Yeah. I think it could have been so much more. I think Indigo Prophecy either is or could have been a better game than Heavy Rain.
Yeah. Yeah. But alas. Anyway.
But alas.
Back to Atmosphere.
Okay. I like Full Throttle. I love the atmosphere in Full Throttle. You know, when you start the game and the Gone Jackals song starts playing and it's just thing, and you've got Ben, you know, when I smell, and you just like, it's just like this. When I smell, yeah. I need to wash. It really sets up. It's like a film. It's like Tim Schafer wanted to write a film, and he's like, oh, okay, I guess I better put some video game elements in there. It really surprised me when you look at the cutscenes, how many animated cutscenes there are.
Yeah.
It really surprised me how much, like, they had to cut out some of the gameplay elements because they spent too much of the time and budget on cutscenes. I remember an interview with Tim Schafer about how he really was excited about moving from the 2D in Full Throttle to the 3D in Grim Fandango because he wanted to do all these different camera angles. And as you know, like, Tim Schafer was inspired a lot by films for games like Full Throttle and for games like, I think Casablanca was Grim Fandango and Full Throttle was Free Rider, was it?
Easy Rider.
I know films. What? So you can tell that he was going for this really cinematic approach, and I think it really works, particularly in those two games, you know. Psychonauts has some great atmosphere as well, but Psychonauts comes across more like a sort of Zelda-style video game.
Yeah.
Because of you going to different areas, just like in a Zelda or a Metroid game, you know, you go to the, instead of going to the fire area and the ice area, you go to the disco area and to like the sensor area and the Milkman conspiracy, which is amazing.
Yes.
For me, Schafer's sort of latter years in LucasArts, not that the early stuff he didn't do was great, but I think the most atmosphere he ever got from, you know, adventure games was there. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Broken Age if that's released.
Yeah.
Another game, I think, while we're on the topic of LucasArts adventure games gone to platform games, sort of, is Insecticide.
Which
did you ever play that?
I didn't, but that wasn't LucasArts, was it? It was Larry Ahern, but it wasn't.
Right. But that never took off or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I really recommend it. The atmosphere in that game is phenomenal. It's a great game, man. The adventure game parts I really like. The shooting parts I can't comment on because I actually got the DS version and they're almost unplayable in the DS version.
That's a shame.
So I'm actually looking out for a copy of the PC version that's not on Steam so that I can buy it and play it and enjoy it and actually play the shooting bits without going, God damn it, why was this even a good idea? So, yeah, but I really enjoyed the detective segments of it, you know. I think the setting of bugs in a film noir setting really works well, you know. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It reminds me of Sam and Max. Like, Sam and Max is the sort of... They're detectives, but they're also fun at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And Insecticide reminds me a little bit of that. Although it takes itself a tiny bit more serious than Sam and Max, although so does everything else in the entire world. While we're on about noir, you recently bought a game that you haven't played yet that's quite noir in setting, which is Max Payne. The reason I... I was really surprised that you hadn't played it is because Max Payne is really evocative and atmospheric, you know. Mm. It's snowy New York City at night time. Well, what more can you want than that?
Yeah.
But there's, and I don't want to spoil it for you because if I spoil it for you, I'm spoiling a game that I think was great. But there's a couple of little bits where Max goes out of. Well, you have, I guess it's sort of a hallucination.
Okay.
And so there's some creepy stuff in there. So play Max Payne and we can talk about it. And
I'll play Max Payne when it's snowy in New York.
Oh, man.
So I can really... I can go from snowing outside to snowing inside.
Yeah, man. Oh, man. You have to do that. Seriously. That'd be amazing.
I will. But I think we're getting a little long winded. I think we could, if we sat here and talked about every single game.
Maybe.
especially okay. if it's coming out your bottom end.
Yes.
Anyway, so
we're talking about farting, listeners.
Yeah, we are.
Hang on, I'm gonna eat a sweet from my sweet tin while you talk. Go for it.
Okay.
You're lost, aren't you?
No, I'm just want the people to feel the atmosphere of, you know, you eating your sweet.
Oh man.
As delicious. Though they were in the room, or you were in the room with them, eating your sweets.
Well, if they were in the room with me, I'd share the sweets and they'd be like, oh man, I can taste it. But
yeah, well, there anyway. You go. Speaking as someone who has been in the same room as you and has shared sweets, I can say that, yes, except there's the fact that you start screaming like a little girl with delight when you eat apple-flavored Jolly Ranchers.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're getting distracted from...
Anyway, I was going to say that we could sit here all night and or all day talking about, because we're on opposite ends of the earth.
Well, people would love that.
Yeah, but we could. But I think it can get kind of boring if we just rattle on and on about all the games that we like that have atmosphere. So I think we should stop that particular train and take a new one, and kind of talk about what it is about those games, what it is that creates that atmosphere, what separates atmospheric games from non-atmospheric games, and...
A lot of things.
Are there any games that you can cite that clearly wanted to be atmospheric but failed miserably?
Every game ever.
I see.
Are you kidding me? Oh, man. Yeah, oh, man, that's put me on the spot, because I've played tons of games where you can see what they were going for. Man, did they totally fail.
How about
fail.
Tech War?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way,
William Shatner.
I forgot to tell you. I wanted to tell you. I was browsing eBay the other day, and I saw someone was selling Tech War for $25, and I was going to send you the link.
I've seen it for sale for $30, man. Not even in box, just for the CD of Tech War. This is literally, like, one of the worst games I've ever played. So... Let's talk about Tech War. Tech War, and what's really, Tech War really disappointed me, because I knew Tech War was bad before I played it, you know. Everyone goes on about Tech War, how rubbish it is. Anyone that's played William Shatner's Tech War knows that Tech War sucks. But here's the thing, you can see what they tried to do. And I was talking with someone recently, because I've been playing Strife, and stuff like Strife really feels like a precursor to Deus Ex, and... You know, they've got you running around this open world and everything like this, but so did Tech War. Tech War's whole thing was give you this huge big city to explore and just let you go and do what you want. I think it was 95 or 96, which was ages ago, man. It was amazing what they tried to do. It feels like a city to walk around and everything like that, but as soon as you start trying to play the game, the experience falls apart completely. Tech War ruins any possibility it has of being atmospheric by having actual gameplay, which is a shame. And I know other games that do that, you know. There's a Wii game called Fragile Dreams and something about Ruins of the Moon, Farewell Ruins of the Moon, I think, and it's kind of like survival horror, and it's got this really great... It's kind of anime-style, which I don't mind, but it's like this post-apocalyptic Earth scenario, and you... run around like abandoned shopping malls with a flashlight that you point with the Wii remote, which is amazing. Like you've got these huge dark shopping malls that are full of these creepy weirdos and ghosts and all sorts of weird stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you run around shining your flashlight everywhere. And that is really evocative. I found that a fantastic use of the Wii remote, much better than using it as a sword or a tennis bat or tennis racket. You can tell I play a lot of sports. So, but as soon as you have to fight anybody in this game, oh man, it's just like the most annoying thing ever, because the combat sucks, because you have to waggle around your Wii remote like an idiot, and you fight with a stick, and the stick breaks, and so you're like, you have to like, oh man, I've broken my stick, I can't fight ghosts, I have to go and find a new stick. It's the stupidest thing ever. If they had just kept it to shining a flashlight around... And I think there's actually a Silent Hill game on Wii where you just run around shining a flashlight and no actual combat. And I really want to try it, because I think I think Fragile Dreams could have been so much more without gameplay, without combat, just like Tech War could have been.
Well, I can name a game.
Well done for setting me off on a rant.
I knew it was going to happen. That's why I did it. I can think of a game that at the time was seen as an amazing technological feat and probably felt atmospheric to some people, but has not aged well at all and is just laughable now. And of course, I'm talking about The Seventh Guest. Have you played The Seventh Guest?
Only a little bit. I've got it in box, and I've only played a bit of it. I need to play more. Well, I need to.
Well, you don't need to play it more.
Well, I think Seven Guests. It was brand new technology, you know.
It was brand new technology, and it was really showcasing what it could do. I just wish that they had, you know, spent money on better acting and better story and. Yeah. Better 3D rendering, which I'm sure at the time looked amazing, but now you play it, and it's silly. I mean, it doesn't feel like you're in a house. It doesn't feel like you're ever scared. You know, it's really hard to pull off horror in games, especially that sort of, oh my god, something's going to jump out at me type horror, because it's tricky to do, and The Seventh Guest doesn't do it well. You can have as many dark corridors as you want, but, you know, it's just, you can't pull off a dark corridor if it's just a dark corridor and nothing else. You walk
through.
For me, great.
This was something else that I was going to bring up, and I was going to bring it up later, but it fits in now, so I'll bring it up now, screw it. Not just, now, music plays a huge part in atmosphere, and we'll get to that later, but so does sound. You know, ambient sound really plays a lot. I remember I finished Resident Evil 4. And I thought, oh, well, that was an interesting action game, but it wasn't really scary at all. But then a few nights later, I was like, oh, I want to go back and see this bit. And it was quite late at night. And I thought, oh, I'll put my headphones on and play, you know. And, oh, my God. With the headphones on, it is a completely different experience because suddenly all of the sounds. Like, I play games at fairly low volume. I'm a weirdo. I don't like games to be loud. I like games to be quite quiet. So, unless I've got my headphones on, if I've got my headphones on, I love games that, for some reason, I don't know, I like being able to hear everything around me when I play games with the speakers on, but if I put the headphones on, I'm like, you know what, screw it, let's go all the way. So when I put my headphones on and played Resident Evil 4, I was like, oh my god, this is, wow, so much more moodier. I don't even think more moody is correct English.
No, but
F-grade.
We'll let it slide.
But so much moodier, because these, like, you can hear the groans, and it reminds me of playing, like, Doom as a kid. And you can hear the monsters grunting in the next thing, and you can hear them opening doors up and stuff like that. And oh my god, man, sound. Like playing Command and Conquer, and you can hear, like, enemy units dying off in the distance and stuff like that. For me, sound is a huge part of atmosphere, you know, and not just ambient sound, which is very, very important, but also, you know, various sound effects. If you're playing a game and some of the sound effects don't sound, you know, like they should, then it's. And voice acting, you know, then it ruins the experience completely.
Yeah, with The Seventh Guest, you have the unfortunate combination of the visuals haven't aged well, and those can be forgiven because they were a product of the time.
It was mid-90s,
The acting, though, is just awful. I mean, they sound like they're reading off pieces of paper. The dramatic scenes, which are meant to be dramatic, just come off as ridiculous. It's really just terrible. The story is more or less nonsensical and makes no sense, which is redundant, but
I think the 90s in the 90s video games suffered from not really having dedicated writers. You look at stuff like Nightlong, Union City Conspiracy, and it's a fun adventure game and everything like that, but nobody wrote that game. It was just you know, it doesn't feel like anybody's actually sat down and written a story. It was just like, oh, well, we're making an adventure game. We need to have some plot and dialogue. So I think
it's pretty
a lot
much
of games
the same.
It's
pretty much the issue with The Seventh Guest, because it's really just about the puzzles. You solve the puzzles and you get little cutscenes, and the cutscenes don't make too much sense, and then they all kind of culminate into the ending, and then you think, oh, that was it? Okay, great. Fantastic.
Well, people had lower expectations, I guess, but that's no excuse for it at all.
No, it really isn't any excuse for it, but what are you going to do?
What am I going to do? Play superior games.
Yeah, yeah. Good point. Good point. So,
so are any other games that you can think of that that didn't do so great with the atmosphere coming across?
Wow, there's lots of games with... Yeah, I'm trying to think of one that comes to mind, and I don't think I'm going to get one quick enough. Oh, A New Beginning. I really liked A New Beginning, but there were just bits in it were just ridiculous.
Oh.
Like, that was a game... I don't know if it was the poor localization or... You know, because the localization in that game really lets it down, I think. Mm. Although I have talked to people that have played the original German version and reckon it's not just a localization. There's just... They don't talk how people talk. They don't, you know, and... Yeah, but I love the graphics. I love the idea of the setting and everything like that. It's just a shame that it falls apart on some core.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance to get right, because you can have amazing music and amazing sound effects and lousy voice acting that just pulls you out of the immersion, or you can... Any one little thing that's not right can just ruin it, ruin a game.
But what games have really good voice acting? Like, amazing, amazing voice acting? There's no... I don't know. I suppose... No, there are some.
Well, Red Dead Redemption has pretty great voice acting.
Yeah, okay.
And
and
most of Rockstar's games have really good voice acting.
I think games are probably getting to the point where they've got dedicated, rather than just like, you know, voice acting, like in the early Sierra games, voice actors were just the employees, you know?
Right, yeah.
And the writers were just the designers. The designers who were like, oh, well, we need to put a funny response in for this. So I think games are getting to the point... Where, you know, but the games have been that way for a while, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. But I think if you've got somebody more focused on a specific thing, rather than just be like, oh, I have to quickly do this, I'll get this done, and then I'll get on with my actual job, then you've got more chance of having a more successful atmosphere because of that.
Absolutely.
You need to pay equal attention to all... If you're going to have voice acting... And I said this to you the other night. I'd rather play a game that didn't have voice acting than have bad voice acting. And I actually always have subtitles on. If a game has subtitles, no matter what genre, you know, if I could get subtitles in an RTS game, I would. I like reading. Anyway, let's move on.
Yes.
Let's move on.
Yes, let's move on. So, yes, moving on. Creating atmosphere is tricky, as we just said. So, in your games, what do you... When you're creating a particular game, because everything's on a case-by-case basis, we all know that you love creating worlds, and that's your main thing. So, you focus on making your world believable and immersive. What is it that you like to focus on in order to pull that off?
There's a lot of different things. There's no one thing that makes a immersive world. Absolutely not. Obviously, art style is a huge factor, you know? If you're trying to make a dystopian game and you've got, you know, a wacky, cartoony style, as Normality threw me off, you know, that's gonna take you out a little bit. Although Normality manages to recover some of that. But, yeah, it's about finding an art style that is unique to you to some extent, but also feels, you know... Feels like you want it to feel. For me, colors are a huge thing. I work a lot with lights when I, you know, I love working with colored lighting over a dark background, and it's one of my favorite things to do. So, I think it's about looking at what sort of atmosphere you want your coloring and your lighting to achieve. It's also about writing, though. You know, if you're writing a world, and we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. If you're letting people explore your world with various verbs, such as, you know, look, then you should be fleshing out your world while they do that. You should reward people atmospherically and informatively when they explore your world. You know, adventure games are games based on exploration. So if you're clicking look on something, you want to find something out about it that you don't know already. So I really like, in certain games, you know, revealing a little bit of the world if I can, you know. So that's, for me, that's a big part of atmosphere, is letting people explore. One of my favorite things to do in games is explore, which is why I find, we talked about, you know, L.A. Noire and Omicron, The Nomad Soul, is you love walking around these worlds and exploring it and finding out different parts of it. So, yeah, I like giving people the chance to explore and hiding little stuff. You know, I love hiding little secrets for people to find in a world, for them to go, oh, man, I found this, this is... you know, nobody else found this. I've received emails from people who've found stuff that I don't think anyone else has found that pleases me in games. What about you?
Well, yes, but actually I was going to say detail also in art style. You have very detailed backgrounds. Yeah, but I think detail is a very important thing too, because if you're going to have, like you said, a dystopian world, for example, that's in ruins, you kind of, if it's sparsely decorated, for lack of a better word, it's not going to come off as ruined as, even if you're going to have just like a shoebox room, which we both hate doing, everyone hates doing them, yeah, but it's all about the detail, because if you pack in more things to look at, it looks like an actual, like a visually interesting sort of place. It doesn't just look like four walls and whatever it's necessary for gameplay.
This comes down to the exploration aspect again, you know, adventure games particularly are about exploration, and you should let people's eyes explore the scenery. One thing, I was talking to someone the other day about A Vampire Story by Bill Autumn to Moon and Bill Tiller and all those guys, and they do this thing where, you know, you blur out the foreground objects.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that at all. Mm. Especially not in that game, because it's really poorly rendered, but I don't like the idea that you're putting depth of field in, because, man, I'm a human being. I have eyes. I have my own... I blur out the stuff that I'm not looking at automatically. That's what my eyes do for me. You don't need to simulate that. If you've got something in the foreground, I want to look at it. Even if you have badly copied and pasted in Photoshop, Bill Tiller.
Bill Tiller doesn't listen to this podcast.
Don't! You do this every time! Bill, I'm sorry. Listen, I'm really sorry, but here's the thing. You know that scene where you've got that sack of stuff in... I forget which scene it is, but there's a sack of... I think it's coal, or... there's a sack of coal, I think. And there's another sack of coal in the same background that has been copied and pasted so obviously that it's not even funny. Don't do that, Bill. You're a good artist. Dude, you did Curse of Monkey Island and you did... You worked on The Dig. What are you doing? Sorry, Bill. I know he's one of our biggest fans and I hate to upset him.
Yeah.
What was I going on about? I have no idea.
You were talking about how you put atmosphere in your...
Kit. Man, I'm totally ruining the atmosphere of this podcast by being distracted.
What are you doing? Playing games?
What am I doing? Making games? But yeah, it's...
Is that what you're... Tell the listeners, what are you doing instead of being focused 100% on this, on them?
Don't tell them all of my secrets.
I'm not your one.
They don't need to know my secrets.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, so for... As I was saying, I don't like the depth of field thing, you know. It's, as you said about detailing games, you should have stuff for the players to explore, you know. You want them to discover stuff. Like, you like driving around Liberty City. Imagine if it was the same 15 buildings repeated and nothing else.
Absolutely.
You know, that's not immersive. That's not atmospheric.
No.
It's fine if you're playing Mario and you want clouds with smiley faces on it or whatever they have. And the focus there isn't on exploration. The focus in Mario is about platforming.
Exactly.
You know,
Mario
so,
is not what I would call an atmospheric game at all.
Atmosphere of sucking. Sorry.
Atmosphere of colorfulness. But it's the same with me. I mean, on one hand, I want to do detailed backgrounds, but on the other hand, I'm very lazy. And it gets pretty tedious to get, if you have, one of my pet peeves is bookshelves, as you know. If I have a background that has a bookshelf in it, well, putting stuff in that bookshelf, I am very tempted to copy and paste things.
Well,
but
here's
you can get away with it sometimes, but anyway.
Here's the thing about bookshelves is, the problem is we work in low res.
Yeah.
You know, if you're working on a higher res game, you'd have the ability then to sort of make interesting stuff happen with the bookshelves. You know, like put different designs of books in. But as it is, you know, each book is 7 pixels.
Yeah.
If that. So there, I think lower resolution limits you a little bit.
Yeah. But it's also about sound, it's about music, it's about everything. It's, if you're going to have voice acting, it should be
good voice acting, believable voice acting, which is not always easy to get, especially in smaller indie titles or freeware, especially if you do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's a delicate balance that you have to hit. And it also depends on what you're trying to go for, because, like I said, let's take one of your games, for example, Piss, which is incredibly atmospheric. And from my perspective, it's because of the world, the art style. You have the detailed world, you have lots of things to look at, you have these places to explore, these churches and temples and things, so you get, from a writing perspective, you get the sense that this is a world that has a history and that has a lot of things that can be explored in it. You have the music, which is just, it's moody, and even though it's really just kind of one track and on loop, it never gets tiring. It's fantastically done by Captain Nemo, and it just pulls you in, and you just get a feeling that you know that this place is a place. It has substance. It's not just whatever. You feel invested in this world.
I think you mentioned music, and this is something that I wanted to talk about as well that I'd forgotten that I wanted to talk about, and I'm glad you reminded me, because it's a really weird thing. When you're talking about video game soundtrack music, you know, a lot of the times as a designer, as a creator, you want something that's very ambient and not in the back, not in the foreground, not too distracting, you know. But as a musician, obviously, you're going to want to push yourself and make the best track you can and make it complex and everything like this. And mm-hmm. I think there's kind of this divide between what a designer wants and what a musician wants, because you don't really want music that's over complex. You want something, because when you walk around a city in real life, there's no music.
Right.
Unless you get your iPod on, or, you know, there's street performance.
You make your own soundtrack.
Yeah, but there's no, real life doesn't have a soundtrack. So the idea that you'd be walking around the city and there's this music anyway, that's ever present, you know, this omnipresent music, is not realistic at all. So in order to help that build immersion, I think you have to try and find there's a fine line between too passive music, where it doesn't actually really do anything, it's kind of like nothing music, and then there's too active music, where it's too much in the foreground. If you've played a little bit of Ortus, which is one of my games in production, and the music for that I've been doing myself, which is quite a new thing. I've been playing music for years, but I haven't been making music for games for years, because, I don't know, there's probably a reason. And, well, I haven't really had the software or hardware to do it. But so when I was writing the music for that, I was really focused on making this clear divide between, if I'm having particular music for a cutscene where you're not walking around exploring, having very active music, so very in-your-face music, music that catches your attention and makes you think. But if you've got music for an area, if you can even call it music, you know, if you've got music for an area where you're exploring and you're the player and you dictate what's happening, don't try and make it too complex. I remember my very first game that I programmed myself in Aegis 3, in Aegis, one of the 3.0, there might have even just been the flat version 3, was Should I Get Abducted. And I remember Sebastian Feller sent me like this music, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, it's really, really, really simple, and there's not much to it. I'm like, dude, that's perfect. That's exactly what I want. Don't make it any more complex than that, because that's what I wanted, you know? He felt bad because it was the first time we'd worked together, and he was like, oh, this music's dumb and simple. And I was like, no, that's what I want. You know, sometimes, like you said about Piss, it's this looping music, but it doesn't get too old because it doesn't try to be, you know, over complex, I think. I think Captain Nemo managed to find a pretty good balance there. So that's pretty important for me, is finding, if you've got big dramatic cutscenes, you're going to need big dramatic music. But if you've got exploration, you want to have fairly sort of passive music, I guess. You want music with a passive voice.
Yeah. And, well, actually, I was going to mention another game that
that you made, which is the Reaper, and that really got me as far as the atmosphere, not just because it was exciting because of the I'll bleep it out, but because of being able to experience that world that we've been creating firsthand and actually seeing it. Because, I mean, the Rebirth, obviously it takes place in the same world, but at a different time period, so it's not going to be what we're conveying in. So it was cool to actually be able to finally be in that world that we've been talking about for such a time. And the music really helped too, because even though, like you said, it was just kind of whatever, but it really helped that it really conveyed that feeling of, especially if you know what's going on, cause you played the rebirth first. It sounds like what you would think of, okay, a bomb has hit this place. It's all hell has broken loose, you know?
I think the important thing there is to know enough about music to be able to tie them in with your visuals, you know? You want everything to make an experience that feels as a whole. You want a very unified experience. And if you look at something like that, I knew that I was making this dystopian environment, so I wanted I don't want jolly, happy music, you know? I don't want something played in a major key where I'm just like, that's not going to work, you know? Plus, that's copyright to many of that. But there's the thing, you know. So I was like, well, I want something. I don't want a very harmonious sound. So I thought, I'm going to work with a tritone interval because that's the least harmonious sound. And that's pretty much all I did was play, you know, tritone interval over a synth. And then I wanted to have this feeling of a big world around. So I crushed Coke cans and sprayed deodorant cans and played with like my tub of slime into a microphone with lots of effects on, and you get this idea of a bigger world because there's not only did I try and draw a background where you can see part more of the world than you can ever explore in a single game, which I think is a big part of it, but also I tried to make it so you can hear more of the world than you can ever see. So there's this idea that there's this bigger world for you to explore, which a lot of people say about my games, but that's the whole idea, you know. You want soundtrack and visuals and even writing that extends beyond the scope of what the player can see and gives them the idea that there's something else out there, you know, waiting for them. And the music for that, like I said, was very simple, just a tritone interval. And I think that was pretty much it, which is like the stupidest, simplest thing you can possibly do. But because I know a bit of music and I know how a tritone interval works, I know what to put into the song, you know? So I thought, you know, if you're going to make a game that's a sad game, use a minor key. If you're going to make it something that's exotic, use a harmonic minor. You know, that sort of stuff. No, you have to know enough about music or have a good enough ear to hear what works. You know, it's about knowledge. The same with drawing. You know, if you want to draw a game that's lots of detail, you have to have the knowledge to paint lots of detail, which I notice you're slowly, you know, you're getting better at. You're adding detail in.
Yes, thank you.
You know, that's... And you made music for your Oro game as well, and...
if you can call it that.
Well, you like harpsichords.
I confess I love harpsichords.
Yeah.
And I just felt that it suited the character.
Okay. And it does. So. It does. It really does. So I think, you know, in that sense, you know that harpsichord, you know enough about music to know harpsichord is the sound that I want. That's what fits my character. It's the same thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's important. You don't have
to... Cheesy MIDI choir fits when there's something horrible happening. Cheesy MIDI
choir fits anything. I think, as a summary of all of that, I remember hearing a guitarist talk and about playing scales and learning scales and learning all the different techniques. Because for anything, you know, there's going to be a million techniques that you might be like, oh, I'm not, I'm not this person, I'm never going to learn that, you know, I'm never going to learn 3D modeling. Basically, the whole idea is, if you're going to be making a game, and you want to make a game with a certain atmosphere, you should have enough tools in your toolbox to be able to pull off the game that you need to make. You have to be able to execute your ideas, you know, with success. Unless you're freelancing, then you have to execute someone else's ideas with success. But even if you're not interested in sort of learning a certain technique, if that's what you need to learn to achieve what it is you want to achieve, that's what you should be focusing on. Even if that's not, like, you know, for me, I hate drawing with perspective, but I recognize that that's something I'm going to need to spend more time working on, because I want to draw stuff that feels like real cities. So that's something I need to work on, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's the same thing with the music in your game. You should know enough. You should know what a harpsichord sounds like, or what a tritone sounds like, mm-hmm. you know, or what key you should be playing in order to make the music you want. And if you don't have any technical knowledge of that, maybe you'll be able to wing it. Maybe you won't. I don't know.
Or you can get someone to do the music for you.
Yeah, but even if, like, for example, I've noticed with my drawing and stuff like this, you know, I used to rely on no technical knowledge at all, and I just draw what I thought looked good. Mm-hmm. But it's a very inconsistent way of drawing. It's a lot harder to repeat something, you know. You might get it looking right once, but trying to get it looking right a second time, you're like, well, how did I do that the first time?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
You know, so if you build up your technical knowledge to the point where you can repeat what you wanted to do that time and get it again, you can know, well, I know why it worked good because I use this technique, you know. That is when you really start to be able to create a game that's not only atmospheric but consistent with its atmosphere, because you know why it's atmospheric.
Yeah. Also, it's important, too, I think, to kind of get an outside perspective as well on the atmosphere if you're trying to go for a specific type of atmosphere. Because, if I can cite myself, a Golden Wake, one of my goals with a Golden Wake is to evoke the atmosphere of the 1920s.
Sure.
And, yeah, so myself, as the person designing this game, I'm excited about the subject matter. I'm passionate about the subject matter. I'm excited about my game. When I play it, I'm liking it, but I don't know how it feels to someone else who's as familiar or familiar at all as I am, because I've done a lot of research and I know what's going on. So it really becomes kind of a monumental task to be able to evoke this time period, because everybody knows the 1920s. Everybody kind of has this preconceived notion of, you know, parties, the Great Gatsby, the
flappers
and things like that. But but that's kind of just like the condensed version of it, you know. And to just make a caricature of the time period, I think it doesn't really do it justice. So,
well, I think that's a very easy way of doing it, but it doesn't, yeah, like you said, it doesn't do it justice.
There's more to it than that. There's more nuances and things like that. So if you're familiar with it yourself as the creator, it's easy enough to kind of make it feel that way for yourself. But then you also have to make sure that you're expressing that for, like I said, someone who's not familiar with it. So it's important, I think, to have fresh eyes kind of evaluate as you go what you're doing. So it's beta testers, for instance, are an excellent, you know, if you're going to beta test your game and you have questions for your, like a little questionnaire for your beta testers, and you're doing something, I think an important thing to ask is, did you feel immersed? What did this game's atmosphere make you think of, or what did it evoke? And it's important feedback to get.
Yeah, I think also an important bit of feedback is what bits ruined the immersion.
Yeah. What brought you out? Because lots of times people will critique a game and they'll say, well, this was great, but this bit really, really just completely ruined the atmosphere for me.
Happen.
Yeah, it can. And it's easy to overlook it because you've been working on something for so long that you just kind of forget about things.
Especially with the gameplay, that when you're designing gameplay, you know, I don't know if you've ever made an action game, but when you're making an action game, you always make the combat harder than it needs to be for anyone else, or the jumping harder than it needs to be, because you've played it a zillion times and you're good at it.
Mm.
Whereas someone that's just come in has never played it before, go, oh man, this is really hard, I don't like this. So, and it's the same with puzzles and stuff like that, you know. You got to make sure that it's not a designer's game, it's got to be a player's game as well. It's got to be a bit of both.
If something comes out of left field, then it's going to ruin things. Like, Still Life, for example. Still Life is a gritty murder mystery. You're an FBI agent who is investigating a serial killer. At the same time, you're having flashbacks.
I am.
Yeah, you're having flashbacks to your grandfather in 1920s Prague, who's going around the seedy atmospheric Prague and interviewing prostitutes and lowlifes and things like that. So, you know, it's dark, it's atmospheric, and then you have to make cookies. And solve combination puzzles for people who have forgotten the combinations to their safes, which somehow have these amazingly modern combination locks where you have to put shapes into holes.
I think adventure
that kind of
games,
breaks the atmosphere.
Yeah, adventure games fall into this trap a lot.
Yeah.
Where, oh man, it's an adventure game, we need to have puzzles. One game that really I think avoided this a lot for me was Gemini Rue, you know? Rather than going, oh, I need a zillion puzzles, it just made a game about exploring.
Yeah. And it's a double-edged sword because you'll have people who like that, and then you have other people who say, oh, well, there was no gameplay. Like, look at games like Dear Esther or Gone Home, which are all about exploration. And
well, even Journey.
Yeah, even Journey. Journey had some puzzles, though. But
Sort of.
But then you have people say, oh, these aren't really games at all because there's no gameplay. So you can't please everyone all the time, I guess, is the lesson that we learned from that.
Yes, you can! With sweets, delicious.
What about people with diabetes?
Then they have no sugar sweets, delicious. But slightly less delicious. Sugar is delicious. So, yeah, I agree with that, very much so. But you're making a game, you want to be able to, it needs to be interactive.
Mm. Yeah. It does.
So, I don't know where's the line, you know? I think that's what I liked about stuff like Discworld Noir and Dave Gilbert's Black World games, is rather than making lots and lots and lots of adventure gaming puzzles where, like, you know, you go and question people and you talk to them. That sort of... I like the note combining in Black World games. I'm glad that's back.
Mm.
I have to say. But yeah, that's... I think adventure games, and this gets talked about a fair bit, adventure games go, oh, well, Monkey Island has puzzles. Our game needs puzzles.
Yeah.
And that's a trap.
Yeah. You know. Especially if you're going for the Monkey Island variety of puzzles.
I think, like, well, a good example of games that don't really fall into this trap, I think, is the Ben Jordan games. I think somehow you manage to make gameplay that really doesn't fall into that trap of, you know, oh, I need to combine all these different items. I mean, there's adventure game puzzles in them, but yeah. I think they feel connected to the world, and they don't feel like these crazy arbitrary sort of tasks. I mean, there's a few tough puzzles in there, but
yeah,
hard and not good are two different things. I think hard puzzles are quite nice.
And designing puzzles in an investigative game is difficult because ultimately the goal is to solve the mystery, and to have all these obstacles pop up is very easy to take you away from that because you can think, well, I'm trying to solve a murder. Why do I need to make cookies? As in
Still Life. You know? It felt like, it was like Siberia where you have to mix the cocktail drinks. Dude, I don't want to be mixing cocktail drinks.
Exactly. But a lot of people criticize the Ben Jordan games, especially the later ones, for being too easy. But, you know, I just didn't want to. I felt that by case 8, you know, you want to know what the resolution of the story is. You don't want to be solving combination lock puzzles.
It reminds me of pretty good. As someone that likes tough puzzles, you know I like puzzles.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people that's quite happy to sit there with a pencil and paper and work stuff out or work my way through a maze. But I think you got it pretty much spot on.
But it's kind of like, I know you don't watch films, but there's the Scream series, which I only saw up to Scream 3 because Scream 4 was a reboot. But you had Scream 1, and you saw, and I saw Scream 1, and I enjoyed Scream 1. And then there was Scream 2, and I saw Scream 2, and it was okay. And then Scream 3 came out, and the whole big marketing thing was, oh, it's a trilogy. All the rules change. You're going to find out the big mystery that you thought was, that you thought you knew, the big plot twist from the first one. And I thought, okay. And I remember going to see it in the theater, and the first murder happens, and I thought, I'm going to have to sit through an hour and a half of more idiots
pointlessly getting murdered
to get to the end. Can I just fast forward to this bit, to the final bit, like the last 15 minutes where all is revealed? And that's how I felt. That's how it kind of is with puzzles. You know, if you have a game, like a series, an episodic series like Ben Jordan, this is how I felt in with Case 8. I figured, you know, there's all these plot threads that need resolution, and I know the players aren't going to want to be strung along and have to solve all these arbitrary stupid puzzles that have nothing to do with anything just to get rewarded with the story. So I thought, you know, I want them to have a good time while they're doing it. I don't want it to be so much that you just are blocked at every turn and people get frustrated and quit and never finish the game. So yeah, that was my reasoning behind it, basically. By the way, the last 15 minutes of Scream 3, totally not worth it.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind
when I go and see it.
Okay.
About 12 years
too late.
I think you've mentioned an important point, and the same applies with action games and shooters and everything like this. There gets to a point where it feels a lot of the times like arbitrary obstacles, and that breaks the atmosphere for me. There are games where I'm playing like shooter games and stuff like that. I remember even in like stuff like Uncharted, there's just points where you're just like, please, can all of these people go away and stop shooting at me and let me get on with the damn game?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In action games, there's times where there's just waves and waves and waves of enemies, and you figure, how much more of this do I need?
Exactly.
Especially like in side-scrolling beat-em-ups, for example. Yeah, depending on the difficulty level sometimes, it just, you just want to get it over with, and people just keep coming and coming, and you just keep beating them up, and they don't die, and it's,
I think sometimes it makes sense, and other times it is completely unjustified. If you're going to put that sort of thing in the game, justify it. There's a moment in Heavenly Sword where there's a literal army coming at you, and it's the most enemies I've ever seen in an action game ever coming for you, and it's just ridiculous, but it feels like it's a payoff, because the whole story they've been talking about is army, you know? So it's not like you just walk into the room and they're like, oh, we got you, and then there's 1,600 enemies coming at you all at once, you know? There's literally an army approaching. Yeah, so in that case, it feels, you know, it feels like it's been sort of well grounded enough in the experience that feels like an essential core part of the experience. In other games, it's just like, oh, go away. Just,
yeah, well,
where's my nuclear bomb?
I'll tell you, don't judge me for this, but when the Watchmen movie came out, they made some, they did some tie-in video games called Watchmen, The End Is Nigh. And I bought both of them.
I know, because I looked on your PlayStation profile thing account and I saw them there. I was like, Gonzalez, what are you doing?
Well, I bought them and because I like the comic, I like Watchmen, and I thought, well, this should be interesting. Boy,
seriously,
was I wrong.
How much fighting bad guys is in the comic? How much of it is there?
Exactly that. Practically none.
There's practically none.
There's a couple of bits.
There's Rashad in the cell, and there's a few bits, but not much.
Yeah, but it's not the focus. This turns Watchmen into a beat 'em up side scroller, except it's in 3D, which is pretty bad. The first episode is silly, but at least there's some sort of kind of level diversity, even though it's kind of just reskinned enemies. It's six levels of just whatever. And there's kind of a story going on, and there's resolution. The second part, it's three levels, and to make up for the fact that it's less levels, they made the levels longer.
And
by doing so, they added more enemies, which are just reskinned enemies, and it's literally, by the time you get to the third level, which is in this brothel, it's it's basically like a giant mansion that's been converted into a brothel, and every single room you go into, just waves of enemies come in, and it's just nonstop, just awful. And I had a friend come over, because, as you know, I'm a trophy whore, and yeah. I was missing one trophy, and that trophy was play the game through completion with a two-player mode. So I made my friend play the game so I could get the trophy, and I had to apologize to him by the time we got to the third level. He was just like, why is this so repetitive and tedious? And I was like, yeah. I know, I'm sorry.
That was exactly the same for me with Deathspank.
So we got to the end, and I got the trophy, and I thanked him, and then we went out, and I bought him pizza or something to thank him.
That's a decent reward. It reminds me, I was talking, like, Hothead. Is it Hothead that made Deathspank?
I think so.
Something like that. And they made this RPG, and they drew it out so much that I was literally, like, falling asleep. Sorry, Ron Gilbert and Hothead, but I was literally
Gilbert
falling...
doesn't listen to our podcast.
Literally falling asleep.
Look, we all need a catchphrase. That's my catchphrase, all right?
Okay. that's our little quirk of the show. Yes.
Well, now that we don't have...
Now that we don't have redneck rants. But yeah, they just tried to... Instead of having lots and lots of content, there was just lots and lots of combat, and it was really, really dull combat. It wasn't fun. Unlike in Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, where the combat was great, and so it didn't matter that you're fighting a zillion guys, because the combat was good, and you can do lots of diverse things. Whereas you look at something like Costume Quest by Double Fine. And that's an RPG, and it's shorter, and therefore it doesn't feel so drawn out, you know? Because once again, it's a fairly...
Yeah, but even that...
Shallow up. Well, if you think that was bad, compare that. You go and play Deathspank. Or don't.
I don't think I will.
Because, man, Costume Quest is half as dull drawn out as Deathspank. So, yeah, RPGs do a lot with the grinding. But, people focus on quantity over quality, which I hate. People complain about short games. I love short games because there's no filler.
Absolutely. Nothing breaks atmosphere more than crappy padding.
Yes. Agreed.
Padding is just generally not a good thing, whether it's in your game or in your bra or in your underwear. It's just not good.
I always pad my bra.
Oh, okay. Well, that's just because of your sensitive pierced nipples, all six of them.
But yeah, so don't pad your games out with like pointless stuff. And if you are going to have lots of combat, make it interesting.
If you're going to have a maze, at least make it sensible. Make it make sense. Yeah. I'm guilty of having mazes in my games, but I've had in the entire Ben Jordan series, I have three mazes. The first one was a puzzle because you needed an item, you needed to smell your way through the maze.
That was
so
fun.
It wasn't just random. There was
and that was in the very very, very first game.
Yeah, it was in the very well in the remake of
the
very first
edition.
Game. Then in case 6, there was a maze, but it was small enough that
it was not really a maze.
It wasn't a maze. It was catacombs, but you could map them out, and they were in the shape of a minotaur's head. So you know, you
spoiler
figure that out. Yeah, spoiler. And then in case 8, there was also a maze, but there was also a puzzle behind.
There's a puzzle there
behind getting around the maze,
and it was an obvious puzzle.
Exactly. So So if you're gonna have a maze, do that. Don't do like in King's Quest 5. Where you just kind of have to randomly go around and find things in the maze and hope that you're finding everything, or even King's Quest 6.
Are there any redeeming elements of King's Quest 5? No? Okay.
The big part that says the end?
The graphics? They seem and I was going to mention this before when you were talking about something. I don't remember. But who cares, man? I'll listen to the podcast later and go, that's what it was. Yeah, I was going to say, if you're going to have lots of repetitive shooting or fighting or anything like that, make it dynamic, because there's a lot of different elements you can play. If you look at, like, mid-90s shooters where they started to have 3D engines and they could start to do something with it, you know, you look at Quake and Unreal, they both have these elements where stuff like lighting comes into play. There's a bit where you in Unreal where you walk into this mine shaft and the lights go off one by one and the music builds up, and you know something's going to happen, and it's just combat and it's just shooting at something. Like you've been doing for the rest of the game, you know? But somehow, because the lighting goes off and the music goes up, fighting this one enemy suddenly seems really interesting and exciting. There's a bit in Quake in the very first, like right near the very start, where you're walking down these ramps and you have to turn the lights on, and you're turning the lights on one by one, and you can hear guys down the bottom, and they're shooting at you and growling and grunting and doing all that sort of stuff. And it's still the same guys that you've been fighting, you know, and that you're going to fight through the rest of the game. But because you've got lights going on, and, you know, you can't see what's going on and stuff like that, all of a sudden it's more interesting, you know? It's like in Bioshock, in the very first Bioshock, they play with lights. In that, there's a bit where you walk into sort of doctor's surgery, and you can see the silhouette of the doctor cutting a thing on the wall, and just as you walk around the corner, the light goes off, and then the light comes back on again, and he's gone. And you know you're going to have to fight him, but they make it more atmospheric and more immersive because they play with stuff like that. And lights have nothing to do with combat, you know. That's not a combat element at all, but it's a very easy thing to change up, you know, and even if you change the gravity up, if you change the, you know, whatever you do, add new elements to your game to keep stuff interesting, and it will instead of dragging on, it'll stay immersive and atmospheric.
Yes.
And also, I want to just say that the bit with the swimming in Tomb Raider Underworld would be amazing if you didn't have to fight the sharks. Sometimes combat takes away from an action game.
Yeah.
Like I was talking about Fragile Dreams. I think people get too focused on gameplay rather than exploration. People forget that exploration is gameplay.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about Red Dead Redemption before we even came on the podcast, and I was talking about how I really like in Infamous 2, you find these photographs, and you have to find a treasure based on the photograph, and you look for landmarks, and it's quite simple, but it's quite rewarding to explore an environment and find the treasure. And yeah. Red Dead Redemption has the same, where you find treasure maps, and there's clues on them, and you have to ride around the environment and look for clues. And that is gameplay just as rewarding as any of the combat for me in both Absolutely. Of those games.
And I felt like, that was one of my favorite side quests in Red Dead Redemption, because you have hunting and you have a bunch of other stuff, but the treasure hunts was really the best part, I thought.
Yeah, you've got this huge atmospheric environment. It's totally mm-hmm. immersive to go searching for treasure in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. There you go.
Yes.
Make your games more atmospheric by having less gameplay in them. Hang on, that's yes. probably bad advice.
Probably. But speaking of atmosphere, the atmosphere in my room has grown very oppressive and hot, and I need to turn my air conditioning back on, so I think we should probably wrap up this podcast.
Okay.
So...
Are we still recording?
Okay. Yeah. This has probably been our longest podcast ever, but you get a little extra since we're probably not going to have a podcast for a couple of weeks at least.
Well, you're moving places and you're moving cities. But you're still on the same coast of New York. You're not going to like Earth.
Yeah, I'm not switching. I'm not moving time zones. I'm still in the same. I'm moving cities and states, but I'm staying time wise.
So it'll still be 11 p.m. for you.
Exactly.
Podcast.
If we yeah. do it. Mm. Yeah.
Good.
Yes. Good. All right. So. I guess if you want to Twitter us or be friends with us or whatever it is you want to do with us, you can go to Twitter and
not whatever you want to do with us. That's a little open. That's a little much. Hang on now.
Well, I'm a friendly guy. You know,
I'm very sensitive. Can't just do whatever unless you like romance me a little first. Jeez.
Yes, buy Ben dinner first and then go and look him up on Twitter and poke him.
I want to say this. This is I love dinner, man. I love.
I'll so say.
If you are gonna buy me dinner, we'll probably be friends instantly because I love dinner. Me and dinner, I'm like, oh, delicious.
The waiting part is really through your stomach.
Pretty much, dinner for me is like Planescape Torment, and
about
it. Know how I go about it.
We went an hour and I had a half almost without you mentioning Planescape Torment. And you had to do it at the very end.
What was that, Dishonored?
I didn't talk about Dishonored.
Just did then. Gotcha.
Oh! Goodbye.